Welcome to the History Reviewed channel, where we analyze the lies and deceptions of history. There are some things that I've noticed that are really fooling whites in a big way. Even whites who are knowledgeable about race are still being fooled about certain kinds of things. And two areas that concern me a lot is management and IQ, ability, raw ability. In this video, we're just going to take a quick look at management. And it's really management and leadership, because there's been some careful scamming that's been going on for decades, very quietly behind the scenes. And it should by now become pretty obvious to many whites that there is something very wrong. And the place where it's the most wrong is not at the bottom, it's actually at the top. And it makes me think of a discussion that happened in our house in Rhodesia when I was a kid. That young white man that you see in the photo there in front of you, in that black and white photograph, that is my older brother. He's a lot older than I am. And this photograph was taken sometime probably in the early 1960s. And this was when my brother was in the RLI, the Rhodesian Light Infantry. And you can see some cars there in the background. The cars look a lot like 1950s type of cars. And many years later, when the Bush War really hotted up, my brother was called up and he spent 6 months of the year in the army every year. While I was finding these photographs, I want to show you something else quickly. I have quite a lot of photos, not that many, but I have quite a lot of photos from when I was a kid. Back then, it wasn't like now where you could walk around with a phone and take photos and videos all the time. To actually take a photograph was quite a mission. And even the cost of taking a photograph was quite a bit, because you had to take the photograph, then you had to take it off to have it developed, etc. So there are many things that I wish I had photographs of that I actually don't have photographs of. And it's amazing when I think back to many things that I used to see every day of my life, and I never conceived that there would be a time when I wouldn't see that stuff ever again in my life. Anyhow, we're taking a quick diversion here. Whereas the other photograph was from the early 1960s, this particular photograph was probably 1980, probably in the late period of 1980 or early in 1981. And this is a very sad time in my life. I took this photograph. This was at the last place that we lived in Rhodesia. My mom and dad and I moved to Salisbury, which is the capital city. And this is among the last photos that I took before I left Rhodesia to come to South Africa. By then, its name had already changed to Zimbabwe. But what this photograph is this truck here that you see with this canvas and these ropes that have been tied onto it. This is my brother's truck, the same guy that you saw in the previous photo in the early 1960s. This is my brother. This is now probably 13 years or 15 years later. And my brother's preparing to leave Zimbabwe as well. And he bought this truck especially so that he could drive to South Africa and back again a couple of times so that he could move his equipment, because he had a small engineering business and he wanted to move his household possessions as well as his engineering equipment, including his lathes and other heavy stuff that he had from his engineering business. So this is such a trip. So my brother's packed a bunch of stuff on his truck and he's fastened it securely, and he's going to be heading off to South Africa. To the left of the truck, you'll see two little girls there. There's a tiny little girl on the far left and another little girl next to her. Those two tiny little lovely white girls are my brother's children, my little nieces. The little one on the left, when she was really young, and even there, when you look at her, she looks almost like a little doll. Anyway, those girls grew up in South Africa, and can you believe, both of them have appeared as models on magazine covers. The little doll on the left, she became extremely pretty, and she's done a lot of modeling in South Africa. But this was a very sad time, because at this time, my father had just died, and this is pretty much the end of the line for us in Rhodesia. And my brother is actually the guy who said to the whole family, he said to all of us, as a result of his time in the military, he said to all of us, he told everybody, even my father, he said to all of us, he said, we've got to get out of this country. These blacks are communists, and this Mugabe is the worst of the lot. We've got to get out of here. And it is amazing that in our time there, that we'd never really considered, none of us had actually considered leaving Rhodesia. It was never even something we thought about. But the whole thing that resulted in us leaving happened in like about a year, when Robert Mugabe won the elections. And Mugabe was the worst of the lot. And when he won the elections and everything, all the whites were really freaked out. And 2/3 of the white population of Rhodesia left in the next 5 years. In 5 years, 2/3 of the whites packed their bags and left. And we were among them. And I can tell you that even 2 years before this, we weren't even ever thinking of leaving the country. And then when Mugabe won, that's when it was time to get the hell out of here. And that was 40 years ago. Now in 2023, it's 42 years ago. I was 17 years old at the time. My brother was actually the one who organized himself the best and was in the best position to leave. I was the youngest. I was 17 years old. And I was actually the first member of our family to come to South Africa. I was 17 years old, and I came to South Africa with 2 suitcases and 200 rand. And back then, a rand was worth more than a US dollar. Despite the US government printing dollars like crazy, the fact of the matter is that the US dollar has still done a lot better than the South African rand. So when I came with 200 rand, it was equal to 270 US dollars. So I came to South Africa at the age of 17 with 2 suitcases and the equivalent of 270 US dollars. So a rand was worth more than a US dollar back then, but now it is 18 rand to 1 US dollar. So despite the US dollar not being that great, it is now 18 rand to a US dollar and falling. It is just a matter of time before we get to things like 20 rand to a US dollar. But anyway, that photo was a photo from a very sad time, and that was my parents' last house. That is where my father died, And my mother then had to stay behind for another 2.5 years to sort out my dad's will. But the whole leaving of Rhodesia was a whole freaking mess. We were totally unprepared for it. Totally unprepared for it. Let me show you how badly prepared we were for it. My father always believed in buying land. And although my father was never rich, from a very early age, he would buy land whenever he could. And here in Africa, unlike America and unlike Europe, if you buy land, its value goes up. It never comes down. And that is because the population is growing. So when my father was very young and he got married to my mother, he lived in South Africa and he bought a plot of land. And he paid a ridiculous sum of money for it. Back then, I think they were working in British pounds. I'm not sure if my father bought a plot of land for about £5, whether it was 5 South African pounds or 5 British pounds, I don't know. But I think that they were using pounds as a currency in South Africa when my dad was very young. So he bought this little piece of land and he went to Rhodesia with my mom and they stayed there for a couple of decades. In the mid-1970s, an uncle of mine pitched up at our farm in Rhodesia. The uncle came with his wife. It was an uncle that I only ever saw once, and this was one of my father's brothers. And he was struggling in South Africa. And he came to visit my father to ask him about that piece of land that he'd bought. And he'd bought this land at a little town in the northern Transvaal called Naboomspruit. And he asked my father that since he's no longer living in South Africa, could he get that piece of land? And my father gave my uncle that piece of land. And off he went. 5 years later, here we are wanting to get the hell out of the country. And so we get out and we go. And later, as we are settling in South Africa and trying to find our feet and trying to get jobs, etc., at a point, my brother starts digging into this issue of this piece of land. And then he discovers that this piece of land, which my dad had bought and which was empty, was now located in the industrial sites of Naboomspruit. And this piece of land was now actually worth quite a lot of money. Plus, when we left Rhodesia, there was a serious restriction on the amount of money you could take. There was even a restriction on the kinds of things you could take. You could not buy a new car and take a new car. You could not take new furniture. So everything that you had to take had to be like second-hand and old, which in the case of my family, everything we had was second-hand and old. So it didn't matter. But there were all kinds of restrictions. And a house in Zimbabwe at that point in time was only worth $10,000. So if you sold a house in Zimbabwe and you wanted to buy a house in South Africa, a house in South Africa was many times more expensive. So most of us could not buy a house or even buy an apartment in South Africa when we got there. My brother was actually the only guy who had enough money that he could buy himself a house when he got to South Africa. But for the rest of us, it took us a long, long time before we could afford any property in South Africa. I was in South Africa for about 8 or 9 years before I could even start buying a small apartment. But anyway, that was just something from the past. Let's return to the original topic. But I will add that it is all these kinds of experiences from the past that caused me to realize the importance of watching politics. And that is why I watch politics and wars like a hawk, because I now know the kinds of things that can happen to a person if you aren't prepared. And as we are heading into a time of ever greater war and instability, this kind of stuff is going to affect more and more people. So let's return to earlier in the 1970s, when Rhodesia was still doing well and hanging in there. Now, to the north of Rhodesia was a black country called Zambia. Previously, this had been known as Northern Rhodesia. Now, Northern Rhodesia had been politically linked to Southern Rhodesia. I'm not going to go into that time period now. It's not relevant for this video. But the British had created, for a time, a thing called the Federation of Rhodesia and Nyasaland. And basically, it was a liberal experiment. And it was all about speeding up the development of the blacks so that they would want to stay united with the whites. But this thing was a flop. The whites helped the blacks to progress, and the blacks still kicked the whites in the teeth. And the two other states, Northern Rhodesia and this other country called Nyasaland, the blacks in those countries said, no, we want independence. So this guy that you see on the screen in front of you, his name is Kenneth Kaunda. And he became the first black president of Zambia, which was previously Northern Rhodesia. So this was the outcome of all this weak, pathetic British nonsense. And Kenneth Kaunda became a big name in African nationalism. And when he finally died, you can see they regarded him as one of the giants, one of the giant great leaders of Africa. It says, Kenneth Kaunda, the last giant of African nationalism and benign autocrat, left a mixed legacy. So the photo on the left is a photo from back in the 60s. You can see Kenneth Kaunda with his very dark skin in his white suit. And this other photo on the right, that's when he was a lot older. Kenneth Kaunda was for a long time a prime enemy of Rhodesia because he allowed other black terrorist movements to set up bases in his country. And his country was a problem for Rhodesia right throughout the war. And he was the first black to actually allow black terrorists into his country and for them to then attack Rhodesia. And this is also the same guy who then went to the British and he asked the British for protection against the white Rhodesians. And can you believe that for a number of years, the Royal Air Force actually had to fly patrols along the border of Zambia to protect these blacks, from the whites, from the white rebels in the neighboring state. Can you believe that? Yes, the stupid British sent their military to protect a black state, a hostile black state, to protect them against the supposed threat of the whites. Small group of whites south of them who were a threat now. The reality is that the British had a lot of mining interests in the north of Zambia, and there were a lot of white Brits working in the north of Zambia. So the British had no problem. They really didn't have a problem with multiculturalism working with blacks, they didn't give a shit. The British are only interested in money. Anyhow, I did a whole video about why Britain didn't invade Rhodesia, and in there I discuss these issues in more detail. At least the white guys in the British Air Force got along great with the white Rhodesians. But still, it's ridiculous that a small group of whites fighting for their survival then find that Britain is protecting these blacks. And these blacks are Russian-loving, Chinese-loving blacks. But what they don't tell you about Kenneth Kaunda is that he was Dr. Kenneth Kaunda. Kenneth Kaunda had actually been a medical doctor, and now he was the president of Zambia. There were a couple of blacks who became leaders of nations who had the title of doctor. A couple. So in the early 1970s, I remember my brother one day being at the house, and he was saying to my mom, he said, "If Kenneth Kaunda can be a doctor, then so can I." My brother was so disgusted to see the media and the British talking, "Oh, Dr. Kenneth Kaunda, the honorable leader of Zambia, you know, a man of such great stature, blah, blah, blah," all that bullshit. So it disgusted my brother, and Rhodesians in general were all racists, and we didn't like any of this pandering to the blacks of the British. But that then raises the issue, exactly as my brother had said back then, about ability. Because my brother couldn't believe, you know, how is it that a black can become a doctor? He can't be a very good doctor. But even stranger is how come he can be the president of a country? Does he have the necessary brain power and skills that will allow him to run a country? Now, in this video, I'm not going to be discussing technical ability. I'm not going to be discussing IQ and skills. Because even though that is an area that's harder to lie about, even on that topic, whites are being fooled. There are highly technical topics or subjects or jobs where whites are being fooled as well. But I'm not going to go into that in this video. In this video, we are looking at management and all the positions at the top. All the positions, the high-powered positions. Positions where you manage people, where you manage an organization, where you manage a company, where you run an army, where you run a government, those kinds of positions. And in that regard, I reckon that whites across the world have been universally fooled, totally and utterly fooled, regarding leadership and the importance of good quality leadership, to the point where white people no longer know what good leadership really is. That leadership has been so abused, and the whole thing is such a scam, that whites have forgotten what good leadership really is like. That very quietly, for decades and decades now, very quietly, we've been able to move into a world where more and more people with less and less skill, people who are literal retards, are getting into very, very high positions of power, and nobody's noticing skill anymore. So you could literally take some black bum off the streets and make him the president, and things will run the way they've run before. Obama is a case in point. President Obama of America. That was another horror story that I never even imagined I would see in my life, that America would be run by a black. And when I watch YouTube videos that come from various American TV shows, especially news shows, I see blacks all over the show. Yet blacks are barely 12% of the American population, but you see them all over the show. And especially in government, in high positions in government and military. And I can believe that white Americans are fooled by this. They don't even think about it anymore. Yeah, that black got there. He's more deserving. But the real issue is skill. If you look at European history, if you look at white history and the way that whites view society is that whites believe in merit. White people everywhere believe in merit. And it's so natural for whites to think in those terms. If you were to say to a white person, listen, we are two candidates for that job. Now, if you had to tell whites anywhere on the planet, I've got two candidates or three candidates or 100 candidates for a job. All whites everywhere on the earth, all whites everywhere on earth would say, well, you give the job to the guy who's best. If it's a job that women do, then you find the best woman. If it's a job that men must do, you find the best man. You always give the job to the person who is best at it. Go and ask or have a discussion with any whites in any society, in any country, and you will see that all white people think like that. That white people think in terms of merit and ability. That we give jobs to the people most deserving. That when there are five candidates for the job, you find who is the best of the five candidates, and that's the person who's going to get the job. And if I was one of three people applying for a job, and I find that I didn't get it because somebody better than me got it, then I would understand. I'd understand, oh, okay, I wasn't good enough. I'm going to have to improve my skills, and then maybe next time round I'll get the next job. That is how all white people live and think. All white people live and think this way. It's so natural, it's like breathing. And that's the way we look at life. And merit and meritocracies are popular in white history. Whenever whites live in a country where skill is rewarded, whether it's Napoleon's France, Hitler's Germany, America, or anywhere else, you will see it's very popular and whites go for it. The Roman Empire was run on that basis. One of the most successful and greatest societies ever produced by whites. And it was full of competition, man. But nowadays, without realizing it, whites have not been taking note carefully enough. Of course, here in Africa, where we whites have been forced to be ruled by blacks against our will, against our wishes, we've had to watch all kinds of fools and idiots and con men being promoted to all kinds of high positions. However, in the Western world, in Europe and Britain and America, people don't seem to have realized the extent to which the higher level jobs, the jobs where there are raw power, management jobs are jobs where you've got raw power. You have the ability to hire and fire. You've got budgets. You can buy things or not buy things. And this is in the corporate type of world. But in government, where you can put people in jail, you can attack other countries, you can strike deals, you can make laws, you can change laws. All of these positions have got tremendous amounts of raw power. So if you're the president of a country, you can pass a law, and all of the police and the courts have to see to it that that law is put in action, is put in place, and that anyone who violates that law is punished. That is raw power. And when I look at the world these days, I reckon that the common white person, the average white person, doesn't realize it, but from the average white person down to the lower levels, that whites have been screwed over royally. And I think that even some people who get to partly high positions, that they don't really get to the positions they deserve. Now, I never used to think like this, but about 15 and 16 and 17 years ago, when I started African Crisis, and I began to look at things politically, and I started dealing with people, and I started trying to also make political friends, try to find allies. I've never even discussed those things that I did, where I was trying to do things and meeting with people and trying to see, where could I get funding? How could I do this? Who will be our ally? Who is on our side, etc. And back then, I also had Jewish friends. And as I spoke to people, I spoke to whites and I also spoke to Jews. And as time went by, I began to realize that there is a system out there. There's a system, and that system is artificial. And that this system actually stops whites from rising. I noticed it even in the corporate world. I noticed, for example, how a guy who's a faggot, he's gay, and suddenly you see this gay guy just rising right through the ranks. All the other heterosexual white men, all the other heterosexual white men have got mid and lower level jobs. Maybe not even mid-level jobs, lower level jobs. And here's this faggot, and the faggot just goes right up through the roof. And I noticed how white women also would just go through to higher levels. But you'd never, never see a white male move up. All the white males are kept down at a certain level. They don't go higher than a certain level. They are maybe in the lower levels of management at best. And then you'll see blacks and coloreds and Indians, faggots, women, everybody going past them. But you see, all these white guys are just stuck at that level. And none of them ever move higher. Except for the rare white. There's maybe a rare guy that does get to the top, but that would be like one guy in 1,000. One guy out of 1,000 might actually somehow manage to move up, but it would be very rare. Meanwhile, when they have meetings, you'd see most of the high-level managers are either blacks or women, white women, and that kind of thing. And then when I spoke to Jews, especially one particular Jewish woman that I knew, I actually want to talk about her as a separate topic because she was very fascinating. I began to realize that the upper classes, that there is a selection process that's going on. So it's not just inside the corporations where there's a hidden selection process going on. There's also a selection process that's going on in business. And it's invisible. So we were taught that there's a thing called the free market, that there's a free market that anybody can do business, that anybody can trade, etc., etc. But those of us who are in the white right, and anyone who's been involved with the white right, you'll know very well that there is no such thing as a free market if you're a right winger. If you're a right winger, funding to you gets cut off immediately. You get banned here and banned there. We all know about the PayPal stuff, etc. So people have been tossed off platforms, etc. So the white right knows for a fact, and lots of people have taken beatings over this, people in the white right know that, yeah, the free market exists if you're a liberal. If you're a liberal or a leftist or a communist or a Jew or a black, yeah, then sure, you can make use of the free market. But if you're a national socialist or a fascist or even a conservative these days, then you'll suddenly find that there's all kinds of stuff that stops you. So I've come to realize that all this talk of capitalism, free market, free everything, you can start your little business and go and do trading. No, you can't. Not if you're a right winger. Not if you're a right winger. Not if you're racial. Not if you're pro-white. If you're pro-white and you try to start a business or do something pro-white, that's going to come to an end. They're going to cut off your sources of funds. And in some countries, people's bank accounts are shut down. There's a whole bunch of stuff, nasty stuff, that happens to you based on your politics. But you know, even normal whites, who are just ordinary whites, and they aren't political, I want to tell you that even those whites have got things that are holding them back. That there's more going on than meets the eye. That the common person, the common white man and woman, will find that they are prevented from all kinds of promotions and all kinds of opportunities. Now, here in South Africa, there's a bunch of laws that favor blacks. You've got all kinds of laws, affirmative action. You've got affirmative action even in a country where blacks are the majority. Where blacks make up 80% of the population, they still need affirmative action. And they've got even more than affirmative action. They've got things like BEE, where they get given chunks of people's businesses. And if you look around, you'll see that there's lots of charities, lots of NGOs. I'm starting to hate NGOs as well, non-governmental organizations. I'm looking at these things with more and more of a jaundiced eye as time goes by. And there are all kinds of programs, government programs, international programs, all sorts of programs where blacks can get money, funding, opportunities, all kinds of stuff. So what you really have is you've got all kinds of weirdo discrimination that exists. And the people who are the consistent losers are whites, especially white males. So now you get all kinds of bozos, clowns, liars, thieves, communists, just assorted junk moving up through the system, sexual perverts, deviants, pedophiles, faggots. You find all these kinds of people, they are moving up, but when it is a heterosexual man or heterosexual woman, then you'll see that there are all kinds of things stopping you. And then it becomes interesting who starts succeeding and why. I've told the story before about the guy I worked with in the bank in the 1990s, Johan. So I'm just going to repeat a little bit about Johan. Johan and I worked together and we got along very well and we talked about everything under the sun. And then Johan resigned, and when he resigned, he called me into his office and he showed me quietly a letter of appointment for National Intelligence Service in Pretoria. So that is like going to the CIA. The NIS is South Africa's CIA. So Johan went and he joined NIS, and he'd even said to me, "Jan, if I find out some things, I'll tell you, man," because Johan and I were good buddies. And Johan did phone me and we did talk and we even met a couple of times. Until in the last time that we met, he came for a barbecue and he brought a woman with him that I didn't know, a white woman, and he and the white woman acted very strange when we had the barbecue. They would start walking through my house and suddenly this one would go here and that one would go there and they'd do weird things. And I found Johan so weird then that I cut off all contact with him and I stopped having contact with him. But in the prior years, the couple of years that I was able to talk to Johan and he was still very cool while he was working for National Intelligence, Johan mentioned a couple of very interesting things. One of the things that Johan mentioned to me the one day was he said to me, "There are lots of financial conspiracies. Lots of financial conspiracies." So being in NIS and basically being a government spy and them having the ability to spy on other people and watching other people, he had picked up that there are these financial conspiracies, and his specific words were, "There are lots of financial conspiracies." Back then it had no meaning to me, but nowadays when I look at people like the Jews and also the Freemasons, I now look on things differently. My entry to Freemasonry actually started in 2018. It was after I went to Kulini when there was violence there, and I ran into some other whites, and I made friends with whites in that area, and then those whites began telling me about Freemasons in South Africa. And I actually met a guy who was an ex-Freemason and very proud of it. And he even came and showed me all his various certificates and things from the time when he was in Freemasonry. And I spoke to him at length. I even stayed at his house. And I spoke to him and I could see how he thought. And these Freemasons are globalists and they are not pro-white. They are diversity-loving, multicultural-loving anti-whites. And money is related to them. So that was where I learned that in that area, there are lots of white farmers and they're managing to carry on or struggle on, some doing better than others. And then there's this one farmer who owns 27 farms. And then I heard he's a high-level Freemason. So the high-level Freemason, he owns 27 farms. All the other farmers only own one farm or one and two farms. But that guy who owns 27, he's a high-ranking Freemason and lots of people know he's a Freemason. And South Africa's got lots of Freemasons. Lots. And Freemasonry was very active here, even in the time of white rule. South Africa, I discovered, has so many Freemason lodges, it's horrific. Even Rhodesia had a couple of strange odds and sods that I didn't know about until much later, like the Round Table. And we thought the Round Table was a charity, but meanwhile the Round Table is something else. So the more and more I look at things, the more I reckon that business and all kinds of positions that were originally meant to be for the common person. Because democracy is meant for the common person. and voting and free speech, these are things that are meant for the common person, and that the common person is supposed to have access to higher levels of society, that a common person can get into parliament or congress, that a common person can be allowed to get a job that he is capable of doing, that a common person should be allowed to be promoted, etc. That actually, very quietly, for a long time now, I think Jews, Freemasons, and all kinds of other weirdo scum and related scum, and also political related scum, have been quietly forming all kinds of secret societies and groups. And these people now pull the levers of power, and they control who gets in there. And at the top of the list of people who control who goes to higher levels, the people that are most aggressive about stopping whites rising are Jews. But this stuff is global. So there are these tentacles all over the show in every country. When I visited America and I was in Memphis, the guy who was hosting me took me to a place. He said to me, here's the local Freemason lodge, and it's public. And he drives up to it, and there you can get out and have a look at it. Yeah, there it says, Freemasons, you know, this is our Freemason lodge. But there are lots of conspiracies. Now, in South Africa, there's also the Broederbond, which is the one conspiracy that I approve of, because it's a white conspiracy to help whites. But that's a topic for another day. The Broederbond may now have become well embedded with Freemasonry and Jews and all that, so they may well have become idiotic. But the Broederbond was a good thing in its time, originally, 100 years ago. Even 50 years ago, it was still doing good work. But what I'm getting at is that I think that there are lots of these conspiracies, and these conspiracies and these Jews are functioning more and more aggressively at higher and higher levels. So if you've got a white heterosexual guy and he's just a fitter and turner or a computer programmer or an accountant, that's okay, he can do his job, nobody cares. But if he should start rising through the ranks, there's a point where they need to start filtering out people. And I learned this also from the chat that I had with a number of chats that I had with that Jewish woman that I knew. I began to look at things, and I want to tell you that I think that there's much more to this than meets the eye. I think that there is a lot of stuff. There are even secret signals that these people have that allow them to know who's who. For example, and we'll get back to this Jewish woman, but for example, I was chatting to this Jewish woman that I knew, and I'd actually met her at the bank. I'd met her at the bank, and I got to know her for a number of years, and her husband was an Afrikaans guy, and I would visit them and talk to them. And at a point, I spoke to this Jewish woman about how do people get into meeting the elite, the upper classes. Back then, I was still thinking that maybe there's some kind of liberal angle that could work. And she began saying to me, well, the first thing you must start doing is you must dress differently. You must wear different clothes. The clothes you're wearing are too drab. You need to start wearing more colorful clothes. And she was very much into the idea of wearing pink shirts. And I said to her, no, I'm not wearing a pink shirt. But she was very much into these kinds of things. And she said, you have to dress like this and you have to be like that and so forth. And the more I looked at it, the more I thought, you know, I actually don't like this. And that has caused me since then to really start looking at the upper classes And also the values and the way they dress and the things they say. I think that there are things that are used to filter people out and to start testing people to see, are you going to fit into these classes? If you are right-wing or pro-white or you're racist, then you can't come to dinner. You cannot be in this society. I think that they have got methods of filtering things out, and it's subtle, and it blocks 99% of the people. And most of the common people will never get in there. I am absolutely convinced, and the more I look at life and the more I look at all kinds of things, the more I want to tell you, I'm absolutely convinced that people who are moving up in ranks and people who are getting money are getting it through secret systems that exist that have ways of diverting money and positions of power to people that are approved of. And this is happening everywhere. It's happening in America. It's happening in South Africa. I'm sure it's happening everywhere. Maybe more so in some countries than others. But I'm sure that Britain is full of it. But I'm sure it's so everywhere. That people are moving around, and if you've got the right political angles or the right racial angles or whatever it is about you that's approved of, you can move up. And if you do the right thing, money will flow to you like a river. And I'm starting to think that money is much more controlled, and that money is a very controlled thing, and that certain groups have got a firm grip on money. And big amounts of money don't move without certain permissions. And that somebody who's nobody can become very wealthy if he's in the right setup, if he's approved of. So what I'm getting at is that I think that the Western meritocracy, that, you know, Western democracy is supposed to be democracy for the common man. Supposed to be democracy originally for the common white man and woman. And that all of those things have been taken over, that slowly, without anybody realizing it, all kinds of weirdo groups have moved in, and they're working probably together in concert with each other, and they're all working together, and they control all kinds of positions and money. Take, for example, the black Marxist. A Marxist is just another name for communism. Take, for example, the black Marxist Obama. Obama was nobody, and then suddenly Obama gets $750 billion from Jews for his presidential campaign, and bing bang boom, there is Obama, and there he is, the president of the United States. So to become president, there's a money issue, because you need access to lots of money. And that's already another way that democracy has already been subverted across the Western world, especially America, because you need large amounts of cash in order to even just run a campaign. So that already gets rid of lots and lots and lots of people who otherwise would have stood a chance to get into government. I'm absolutely convinced that everything's been hijacked, including free speech. That is something that I need to come back to as a separate topic, how they hijacked free speech, how they took free speech, which the common person is supposed to have, and they took it away from everybody, and you didn't even realize it. But the real thing is that white people are very trusting and very tolerant of society, and whites have watched strange things happen and have begun to regard it as normal, when in fact, behind the scenes, there are secret groups that are actually hard at work, seriously hard at work, seeing to it that people who have got certain abilities do not rise if that person is a person who might be, quotes, a racist. In other words, he's going to love his own people and look after his own people and his own country. If he's a racist or a nationalist, he's going to be stopped. Or his career, his upward path is going to be blocked at a certain level. I'm absolutely convinced that there is a glass ceiling there. That there's a glass ceiling. However, there are some industries where people still manage to maybe bypass the glass ceiling. One such area is farming. Because farming is something that's hard, it's a very hard job, and it's not the kind of job that Jews, for example, would like to do. So you find lots and lots of white guys who go and do farming, and they love it, even though it's hard work, tough work, dangerous work, and they can still make quite a bunch of money. So you find that maybe here and there, you get like a farmer who will break out and move to a higher level because he's in an industry that's not Jewish controlled. And if there are Freemasons there, there might not be that many Freemasons there. But all in all, the common person, I am convinced that the common person has got all kinds of things that he doesn't know he's being screwed over on. Now let me show you a very interesting news story. This news story comes from a woman in India, and she's actually pretty good. She's quite passionate about her stuff, and she puts out a bunch of research, all kinds of stuff, that she's actually pretty good at. And she dares to say things that nobody else will say. And how I got to follow her was because I was looking for stuff about China, and I found that the Indians were the best source of news about China, and I used to watch her stuff. And now she's broken away and she's working for another crowd, and she's doing her own thing like crazy, and she does some good research. So she's doing this for Indians and for whoever else in the international audience. And look at what she talks about merit and meritocracy and what has actually been discovered through some scientific studies. Because you would think that if merit is at work, that the cleverer you are, the higher you'll go. Well, look at this. This might be some of the proof of what I've been telling you, that you are being screwed over and that people around you might be moving upwards, and it's because there's something else going on. Now, she's not talking here about conspiracies. She's not talking about Jews or Freemasons. But what she is pointing out is that the cleverest people, the people who should be moving up the ranks, are not moving up the ranks, and that it's now scientifically proven. So that should show you there's something else going on, that people are being kept down. Why are people being kept down? Because democracy is supposed to be the opposite. And even in normal companies, it's supposed to be that merit and ability gets you to the top, but no. So listen to what this Indian woman says. And this should show you that there's something else going on. There's something else going on.
Our last story is about brains and big bucks. How are they related? Let me rephrase. How much of the success you achieve depends on how intelligent you are? Take a guess, 25%, 50%. And let me tell you, this is not an original question. Nobel Prize winning economist James Heckman loves asking this question. And what's the answer? Innate intelligence has a much smaller influence on success. According to data, less than 2%. But if you don't want to look at data, just look at your boss. You don't have to be intelligent to be successful. And the biggest earners may not be the brainiest. Recently, a study was conducted in Sweden. It found that higher intelligence is related to higher wages, but only up to a point. They've given a threshold of $57,300 in salary, a lot of salary, admittedly, but this is the threshold. Beyond that, the study says, your ability plateaus, but your wages may continue to rise. And to prove this, they took a standard ability test. Do you know what the result was? The top 1% earners scored worse than those below them. In other words, the top bosses were technically not more deserving than those who earned half their wages. So for all you know, you could be the smartest person in the room, though not with the highest salary. And this invites some obvious questions. If ability is not the driving force behind occupational success, what is? And if you're so smart, why aren't you rich? Science, unfortunately, doesn't have a definitive answer, but some studies have tried their hand at solving this puzzle. Some say success is about luck. Others say family wealth plays a role. And another key factor is personality, which is a broad factor, really. All of these are broad statements, but they're talking about conscientiousness, you know, diligence, perseverance, self-discipline. All of this makes a difference. And then there's another surprising factor. Your spouse's personality can influence your career success, they say. This is according to studies. People with relatively prudent and reliable partners tend to perform better at work. But you could say you already knew all of this. I'm sure you did. But how do these studies help us then? They make us think and question the system, the process. For instance, should we stop fussing over IQ scores now? A 2016 study says grades are better predictors of success than raw IQ scores. After all, grades reflect qualities like perseverance plus intelligence. But then grade matters only up to a point. Social skills and motivation also play a role, an important role in career growth. Also, here's a question that we must ask. If the most wealthy are not the most intelligent, can we really trust the decisions they make? And I'm not talking about Elon Musk, it's a general question. There is growing income inequality in the society. The richest 1% have nearly twice as much wealth as the rest of the world put together. $26 trillion to be exact. Billionaire fortunes are increasing by $2.7 billion a day. A billionaire gained roughly $1.7 million for every $1 earned by a person in the bottom 90%. And this study was done in Sweden, which has a relatively small wage gap. In 2021, Sweden's income inequality was 0.34%, their highest in 50 years. So think about other countries in West Asia and North Africa. They have the worst income inequalities in the world. Maybe the gap between intelligence and wages is even more there. And why is this important? Because the decisions that the top earners make have consequences for the rest of us. They drive policy changes in corporations. They also have political clout and the ability to influence policy. So it's important to have the right people in top positions. How do we ensure that? Perhaps by trying harder ourselves. Remember, successful people are not born, they're made.
So how interesting was that clip from that Indian woman? Her name is Palki Sharma, but also notice her facial features. She could be one of those northern Indians that is the result of the interbreeding with the Aryans from 2,500 years ago. And the more I look at business and companies, and I worked in the corporate world my entire life. I worked for big companies, famous brand companies, my entire life, all kinds of household name companies here in South Africa. And as time went by, I became more and more skeptical about these companies. And when it came to race and politics, they disgusted me more and more. But I noticed the problem early in my career. I could already see that these corporates, they do weird things, and I didn't understand it then. But clearly, I'm not the only person who's been noticing that there's something wrong with management. In the American cartoon series The Family Guy, which I think was created by Jews, or Jews themselves are involved in it, they do sometimes have a few scenes that are quite good. In the following short scene, they raise the issue of a Jew willing to be a totally talentless manager for others and to take most of their money. And they also raise the issue of Walt Disney. Walt Disney was one of about two or three white guys in Hollywood who actually fought against Jewish control and lost. So in this little cartoon thing, they've got Walt Disney's voice where Walt Disney says, "Are the Jews gone yet?" And they say no. And then Walt Disney prefers to go back to being dead. So it's a short clip, but as always, it's one of those cases of many a true word is said in jest.
Today. Anyway, you guys got the talent, but what you need is a manager. Someone with no talent who can take a lion's share of your earnings.
You'd do that for us?
Sure I would. So what do you say? Can I be your manager?
You betcha.
All right, put her there. No, I've seen your prescriptions. Let's just say...
Welcome back, Mr. Disney.
Are the Jews gone yet?
No.
Put me back in.
And when it comes to the movement of money, it's very, very weird. Let's go back to Rhodesia again. So when whites ran Rhodesia, whites were under sanctions. Whites were not allowed to buy or sell anything. We had total world sanctions on us. Then comes a rabid black communist. There in the bottom right of the screen, you can see is a quote from Robert Mugabe. It was the election of this guy, which itself was a scam. I'm not going to go into all his scams that he had. But Robert Mugabe won the election, and this is a quote from him. "The only white man you can trust is a dead white man." And this is the guy that we left Rhodesia over. When he came to power, 2/3 of the whites said, "We're not going to live under this guy. You can't live with this guy." The 1/3 who remained tried to work with him for 20 years and then he destroyed them all. So those of us who left were making the wise move. But let me tell you a story about Robert Mugabe. Here's a hardcore commie supported by Russia and China, comes to power in Rhodesia in 1980. And I didn't know this. I only found this out in recent years. I have a German friend and a family member in his family has worked for some extremely wealthy Jews. So from time to time, my German friend has told me some of the things that his family member has told him since he's hobnobbing with Jews. And my German friend told me something very interesting about Robert Mugabe and Zimbabwe. So if you look on this chart here, this is the GDP of Zimbabwe. Of course, the reason that the GDP goes through the roof in 2010 is due to inflation. They ended up in hyperinflation. But if you look at this chart, you'll see 1980, and the GDP of Zimbabwe was $6.6 billion in 1980. But my German friend told me that when he came to power, that from New York, from Jewish New York, $2 billion was given to this black communist from Jewish New York. $2 billion was given to him. So just think about that. The white Rhodesians, totally cut off from the world, totally ostracized, not allowed to trade, not allowed to do anything. This white-hating black communist comes to power, and out of Jewish New York, they give him $2 billion. And this guy later on hobnobbed with Israel, and Israel helped him in so many ways. He did a lot of trading later with Israel. That's a whole other story. Israeli Jews in South Africa even rigged his elections for him. So he was hobnobbing with the Russians, with the Chinese, and with Israel. And he's getting money. Meanwhile, when the same country is run by whites, no money for those whites. None. So anyway, it should be obvious to you that there is some kind of force out there. There are forces out there that are working against whites. Against whites as individuals in their jobs, but also against white countries and whites who want to stick together with other whites. There are things that are not the way they should be. And there must be quite a lot of people who have noticed that as things go higher, things get weirder. The higher you go, the weirder it gets. That's why you see people like Obama becoming president, the Clintons becoming presidents, somebody like Biden, who's got brain damage, is president. There are other factors at work that have got absolutely nothing to do with actual ability, actual popularity, etc. So another thing that also fools people is that presidents and CEOs also have got all kinds of specialists who report to them. So they don't actually have to have much knowledge. They don't have to think things through clearly. They, especially presidents, they have people, they've got whole departments of people with big budgets who come back to them and give them all kinds of facts, and at the end of the day, they just make the decisions. And these people are practiced also at dealing with presidents and people from normal civilian life who don't know about many other things, especially military stuff and secrecy stuff. And so they have their way of dealing with them and giving them information. So at the end of the day, the way that democracy also works is that democracy is not like it used to be. It's not like in the days of kings or in the days of Julius Caesar.